Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, December 16th, 2014. A new poll a week after the torture report's release shows that a majority of Americans approve. This is not America. And they approve of torture, not necessarily the release of the report. Little beats in me. Ouch. So a majority of Americans believe that harsh interrogation techniques, I call them torture, after the 9/11 attacks were justified. And more than half the people believe something that isn't true, that the torture regime produced usable, valuable intelligence. And the margins are shocking to me. It's a 2-to-1 margin, 59-to-31. Support the CIA's brutal methods, and the vast majority of those said that they produced valuable intelligence, and that is the most critical finding of the Senate report, and I'm critical of it being advanced as something more important than morality. But this shows that Hollywood's depiction, its friendly service to the police state, in films like Zero Dark Thirty, in episodic shows like 24 and Homeland, that Americans prefer to embrace the reality of fiction rather than believe a government report based on the CIA's own internal email communications, that torture didn't produce the information like Zero Dark Thirty alleged, that, for example, led to Osama bin Laden. And recently, I've been watching some episodes of Homeland, and I have to say Claire Danes is a great actress, and the show is well written. There's a lot of real reality in the scripts of this fictional show. But in my view, it presents the new normal as just that. Normal. The torture is normal. That these ticking time bomb scenarios, which have never been documented in the real world, are something that we must frequently contend with. And even though, you know, the report found that more than 24 of the prisoners were wrongly held, and we'll get to the details on that in a moment, people seem to accept this. 54% agrees that the CIA intentionally misled the White House, but that doesn't bother them. And the poll didn't ask about all of the other aspects that have been revealed, that hundreds of millions of dollars in bribe money was paid out by the CIA. It's really stunning. And you may recall, some of you, that right after the midterm elections, I dug out an old infographic from, I think, back in 2004. And it shows a map of the United States drenched in red with blue on either coast. And in the middle, the part of the country is called Dumbfuckistan. And that's what I think of when I hear this. 53% of Americans say that the interrogation of suspected terrorists produced important information that could not have been obtained in any other way. And you know they didn't read the report. They may have watched Bill O'Reilly spout off about it. They may have seen a summary in a newspaper. But the ignorance of Americans and their willingness to base strong opinions on that ignorance is really stunning. Only a third of Americans believe criminal charges should be filed against officials responsible for the interrogations. 47% say the report was unfair to the CIA. 52% say it was wrong to release it. 38% of self-identified liberal Democrats say the CIA actions were justified. Now, 7 in 10 think waterboarding is torture, but half say that it's okay under the right circumstances. So we are living in a bizarre time, friends. And today, after juggling schedules for a week, I caught up with Jason Leopold, who is my go-to reporter about torture, about Guantanamo, and these related issues. He's done incredible work, and his FOIA lawsuit was part of the reason that the partial, heavily redacted executive summary was actually released. Here's an excerpt from my fascinating conversation with Vice News reporter Jason Leopold.
It didn't, and that's actually, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, Peter, because that's actually another part that I believe is missing from the report, and that's the use of drugs. The use of drugs for the purposes of interrogations. There's no mention of it whatsoever. And, you know, Jeff and I are both aware that the CIA Inspector General was tasked with conducting an investigation into the use of drugs for the purposes of interrogation based on claims that were made by former detainees. The Department of Defense, they did conduct their a similar investigation and produced a report which Jeff obtained via Freedom of Information Act request, and I believe it's one of the most important documents again to have surfaced over the past decade in this post 9/11 landscape, and so we do know that then Senator Biden also asked the CIA to conduct that. And so there is no mention of this whatsoever. There's absolutely no mention of drugs. And I don't know if it's in the larger report. Perhaps it is.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that would certainly be, crossing another boundary.
You can hear the full conversation with Jason Leopold released to subscribers today here at peterbcollins.com. And speaking of those subscribers, I couldn't do this without Joe Clarici, Chris Welsh, Becky Messer, Andy Krieger. They are solid supporters of this program. Andy Krieger has 2 subscriptions. Thanks, Andy. That's really touching. And I invite you to join the effort to keep this thing going. I'm very independent, but it means that I don't get advertising money. I don't get any funding from foundations or political groups. It's all just me. And so I ask you, without trying to beg or sound desperate, to support the effort. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the sign-up link right under my picture on the homepage. That takes you to the option page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers anywhere in the world earn a bonus copy, a bonus book, a copy of the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's exciting new collection of columns called Empire of Chaos. And over the weekend, the New York Times dug into the angle about the innocent people who were held and tortured by the CIA, at least 26 of them. Dick Cheney doesn't care. You've heard that he didn't read the report that is full of crap. And when asked about the innocent people, he just thought that was an acceptable cost. Wasn't worried about it at all. Well, it's clear that there were more than 26. But working with that bit of information, the Times follows the case of a Yemeni named Mohammed Bashmila. He's been out for 8 years. He was released from CIA custody. But he was tortured in Jordan before he was handed over to the CIA, which kept him shackled at times in a freezing cold cell in Afghanistan, subjected him to loud music 24 hours a day. He attempted suicide 3 times. Another time, he cut himself and used his own blood to write, "This is unjust," on the wall of his cell. And until 9/11, the U.S. condemned secret imprisonment as a violation of basic international standards of human rights, but that was tossed aside. And Barack Obama, he's been holding people in Afghanistan for years. And until the Afghans took over the prison, we didn't even know who those guys were. A fundamental violation of their human rights. And the stories continue to unfold. We know the case of Khalid El-Masri, the German citizen who was mistaken for someone who had the same name. He was grabbed in Macedonia, flown to Afghanistan, 4 months in the CIA salt pit. An Algerian, Laid Saida, was held in Afghanistan for 16 months. And Masri himself tried to draw attention to the plight of Saidi. Among those mistakenly held for periods of months or years include an intellectually challenged man held by the CIA solely to pressure a family member, two people who were former CIA informants, two brothers who were falsely linked to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And so this is just another example of the insidious behavior carried out in our names. And most Americans think it's okay. Yeah, they can live with that. We're number one. We're exceptional. We're awesome. Say the moron info babes on the Fox News channel. Here's another disturbing poll that was released about a week ago, 2 years after the mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and the carnage of a school shooting almost every week since then. Polls show that American public opinion is shifting in the wrong direction. Now 52% of respondents say it's more important to protect gun ownership rights. Now in 2000, only 29% chose gun rights over gun control. In 2013, that number had surged up to 45. But now it's more than a simple majority. African Americans have increasingly become likely to believe that firearm ownership does more to protect people than it does to threaten an individual's safety. And the most obvious and recent contradictory example is a woman who was in the news about a week or 10 days ago, an aggressive advocate for open carry of guns. She shot and killed her husband and child. Yes, guns in the home, guns in your possession are more likely to be used in a fit of anger on someone you know than to protect you from a stranger who invades your space. When asked in 2012, 29% of African Americans said guns offered people protection rather than expose them to greater danger. But that number has nearly doubled to 54% in the current poll. By contrast, the views of whites who believe guns are more likely to provide personal protection have risen to 62% from 54% in 2012. And overall, 57% of Americans say gun ownership is more helpful in protecting people and from becoming victims of crime. Only 38% said it did more to endanger one's safety. So that the idea that a good guy with a gun is the answer to a bad guy with a gun appeals to a lot of, I'm sorry to say, simple-minded Americans. A brutal attack in Peshawar, Pakistan today, and the Pakistani Taliban is confirming its responsibility for attacking the Army Public School and Degree College. At least 145 students and teachers were killed, pretty much gunned down in cold blood. And I don't really have much more to report on that. I can't speculate in any intelligent way about exactly what caused this. The Taliban folks say it's in retaliation for the Pakistani military's offensive against them in the North Waziristan tribal district. So, ugly day in Pakistan. We haven't talked recently about the free-for-all in Syria, but the Assad government lost two critical bases in the northwestern province of Idlib. One fell to a group called Arar al-Sham, and another fell to the Al-Nusra Front. And what's important is that neither of these groups is directly affiliated with the Islamic State. They're battling for turf there. And it is truly a free-for-all. And the U.S. Congress just passed more money and approval to arm the moderates in Syria. We haven't found any, but we've got money for them. And the funding gives tacit approval without really observing the war powers' responsibilities of the Congress. Palestinian President Abbas is going to push for a UN Security Council vote this week on a resolution setting a deadline 2 years hence for ending the Israeli occupation. And the U.S., always backing Israel, does not consider this to be acceptable. Now, there are actually two proposals, one offered by the nation of Jordan and a second offered by France. The French deal seeks a 2-year deadline for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations on the terms of Palestinian statehood. And so the U.S. will run interference. It'll certainly use its veto at the Security Council. But I think this is very important. We're seeing support growing for the Palestinians in Europe. And at some point, maybe it will make a difference. So here comes a story that the New York Times played thusly. It refers to some legislation that President Obama has decided to sign, which imposes further sanctions on Russia and authorizes additional aid to Ukraine. And the New York Times story blandly notes that the bill was approved unanimously by Congress. But Mr. Obama hedged for days on whether he would sign it. And there are good reasons. Because it puts the U.S. in a more provocative role toward Russia, authorizes $350 million in military assistance to Ukraine, and calls for new sanctions. And so you look at that and you say, well, you know, Congress passed it unanimously. When? Huh? How did that happen? Was it in the Cromnibus bill? Well, for the answer, we turn to Dennis Kucinich, the 8-term member of Congress from Cleveland, who got redistricted out of office in the last cycle, 2014. And I will link to his commentary at Truthdig today. Because what he points out is this unanimity in the House actually involved only 3 members. They did it late at night when nobody was watching. He said, under a parliamentary motion termed unanimous consent, legislative rules can be suspended and any bill can be called up. If any member of Congress objects, the motion is blocked and the bill dies. So last Thursday at 10:23:54 p.m., a member rose to ask for unanimous consent for 4 committees to be relieved of a Russian sanctions bill. At this point, the motion and the legislation could have been blocked by any single member who would say, I object. But no one did, because no one was watching for last-minute bills to be slipped through. Most of the House and media had emptied out of the chambers after the $1.1 trillion government spending package was passed. Kucinich continues, the congressional record will show that only 3 of 425 members were present on the floor. They did a little song and dance. 2 of the 3 feigned objection, creating the legislative equivalent of a timeout. Then they made a few remarks, withdrew their objections, and according to the clerk's records, once the bill was considered under unanimous consent, it was passed 1 second later at 10:23:55 p.m. without objection, in one recorded time-stamped second, unanimously. And then the House adjourned. And Kucinich writes that in his 16 years in Congress, he had a habit of camping out in the House chamber near the end of the session, because that's when sneak attacks like this occur. And he said he was ready, if a bill came up, to object and to, you know, nip in the bud this attempted end run. And Kucinich details, I'll just highlight a couple of the points here. There are 12 items in this legislation. They're all pretty onerous. There are sanctions for Russia's energy and defense and banking and investment industries. Provisions for privatization of Ukrainian infrastructure. Ah, the World Bank will love that. That's related to electricity, oil, gas. $50 million to assist in a corporate takeover of Ukraine's oil and gas sectors. And let's not forget that Joe Biden's son, Hunter, sits on the board of directors of the biggest energy company in Ukraine. $350 million for military assistance to Ukraine. $30 million for a propaganda campaign. $20 million for democratic organizing in Ukraine. And the list goes on. Kucinich sums it up. The people of Ukraine will be less free as their country becomes a military state, goes into hock to international banks, faces structural readjustments, privatization of public assets, decline of social services, higher prices, and even a more severe decline in its standard of living. Once, with the help of the West, Ukraine fully weighs in as a military state under the terms of this bill and joins the NATO gun club, says Kucinich, its annual defense budget will be around $3 billion. Each Western incitement creates a Russian response, he closes with, which is then given as further proof that the West must prepare for the very conflict it has created, war as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Thanks to Denis Kucinich for exposing that. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known and I wouldn't have been able to tell you. A few years back, Sibel Edmonds and I interviewed a man named Nick Merrill. Nick is in New York City. He was the owner of a website hosting company called Calyx, C-A-L-Y-X. He received an FBI national security letter related to one of the clients who he hosted on his servers. And the national security letter, as you may know, included a gag clause. He wasn't permitted to tell his client that the FBI had inquired. He wasn't permitted to tell his lawyer. He wasn't permitted to tell anybody. And he refused to knuckle under to this aggressive, unconstitutional incursion justified by the Patriot Act. So last week, Nick Merrill and a team of lawyers from Yale Law School filed a lawsuit alleging that the FBI and federal government are violating his First Amendment rights by keeping him under what is essentially a permanent gag order. Now, when Sibel and I interviewed Merrill a couple of years ago, he was very careful but still quite courageous in challenging this ugly set of restraints. Quoted by Vice News, he says, "I feel it ultimately comes from a place of patriotism and concern for the country and the future of the nation. I thought, the government has decided to say screw the Bill of Rights and is gathering information on whoever they want, whenever they want, and what is the ultimate implication of that?" Now, he, in 2010, filed a lawsuit and the government partially lifted the gag order, allowing Merrill to identify himself as the plaintiff in a John Doe lawsuit, and that he had in fact received the NSL from the FBI. But he wasn't allowed to discuss the details, and he doesn't accept that. And when he went to bat on this, he thought that people like companies like Google and Twitter and others who have a stake in these privacy and issues of government intrusion, he thought they might join him, but he's still out there all alone. "We still don't have answers to a lot of questions," Merrill said. "How many people are under national security gag orders? I don't know. I don't think anyone knows," he said. Buried in last Saturday's New York Times under the Charlie Savage byline, a very interesting development, again based on Freedom of Information Act disclosures. And what the Times got is copies of some of the arguments and rulings from the super-secret FISA court. And this is framed as a kind of duel between two judges, Malcolm Howard and Roger Vinson. So Howard went along with the government argument that changed the definition of a term facility, which had always meant a specific phone number or email address, to broaden the definition to include networks, you know, like telephone networks, email networks. And this became the rationalization for permitting the massive interception of our phone communications, as revealed by Mark Klein, the former AT&T technician here in San Francisco. And the Times notes that in January of 07, Alberto Gonzalez, then the Attorney General, said that the program had been brought under the court's authority under a legal theory he described as innovative and complex, but he didn't detail it. The innovation was to redefine the word facility. And so that glimpse into the FISA court rulings is interesting. I don't know if anything will happen as a result. Couple of shout-outs for Pope Francis. You know, I'm a recovering Catholic. I consider myself agnostic. I think the Catholic Church is irrelevant in far too many respects. He's trying to change my mind. The other day, he called for humane treatment by the United States of our prisoners, including those at Guantanamo. I applaud that. And when the previous Pope, Benedict, also known as Cardinal Ratzinger, when he had zeroed in on outspoken American nuns and tried to silence them by putting them under control of a cardinal and launching an investigation into the activities of nuns in the United States, well, that investigation was finally published yesterday. And it's far different from what we expected. It's a report that expresses appreciation for the achievements and the challenges that Roman Catholic nuns, particularly those in the United States, face. Nice job, Frank. Nice job. And finally today, my friends David Swanson, Norman Solomon, and Jeff Cohen over at Roots Action have put together a petition that I am about to sign. It's called a Declaration of Independence, and it reads, "In the course of decades of national political decline presided over largely by two ruling families, it becomes necessary to declare our independence and seek new leadership and new direction. I therefore join with others in adding my name to this document, pledging to reject future domination of government by the Bushes and the Clintons, and by Bush-Clinton-like policies." Yes, no political dynasties in the United States. That's why I supported Obama over Hillary in 08. And what did we get? We got the second set of Clinton terms. And if Hillary's elected in 16, that will become the fifth Clinton term in reality. And so I do think we need to break from both the Bushes and the Clintons. And if you think I'm just a crazy lefty, consider that the matriarch of the Bush family, Barbara, who is still lucid in her early 90s, said, "Oh, for God's sake, Jeb, can't we find somebody who's not a Bush to run as the Republican nominee in 2016? I'd like to say happy trails to both Bushes and Clintons. Who needs them?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until